Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis, your host for the next hour or so. Today's edition is for Wednesday, April 25th, 2012. Welcome to our program. As ever, it is good to be with you. In this week's edition of Planet Waves FM, I'm continuing with the Dr. Carl Grossman interview that we began a week ago on Sunday. So, in a sense, I'm combining the special edition that was planned for Sunday and the regular edition that was planned for today. I'm not going to say too much before getting into the Carl Grossman interview, except to note that we are on the anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, which happened April 26th, 1986. Dr. Grossman, as you may have heard if you listened to part one of the interview, is one of the world's leading anti-nuclear experts. He's a journalism professor at SUNY Old Westbury. And in part one of his interview, Carl made a few different points, one of which was that there is no such thing as the peaceful atom. What he said is basically that once a country has atomic energy, it is only a short time before it will get a nuclear weapon. And while I don't agree with all the war hype in the Middle East and the constant vilifying of one country after the next, I will say that it would be a good idea if we were to not facilitate any other countries getting nuclear power, because the connection is so strong. And as Carl explained, nuclear power is merely an outgrowth of the limited potential of the nuclear bomb industry. You can't really use a lot of nuclear bombs, and you can't really manufacture that many because there's only so many that a country needs. And so what do you do with this nuclear technology? Well, you boil water with it, and then you think about doing things like powering submarines with it. And then you think about doing things like powering ships with it. And then when that's all done, you think about powering airplanes. Currently, there's a plan to invent nuclear drone aircraft that would be able to fly for months on end without refueling. And then at the same time, there would be aloft all over the place all of this uranium and plutonium. Not a good idea. So Carl covers that and a few other things. And in this upcoming section of the interview, he tells a story near and dear to my heart, which is the story of how the nuclear park that was supposed to be Long Island, that is to say this massively populated group of New York suburbs, which consist of four counties, Brooklyn, Queens, and then Nassau and Suffolk counties, were going to be a kind of nuclear park. They were going to put 10 nuclear power plants. And because activists, the political community, the media, and many other people, basically citizens, got involved in shutting down the Shoreham nuclear power plant project, the whole nuclear park never got off the ground. So we're going to hear that story. Just briefly, considering the chart of the Chernobyl disaster from April of 1986, this is one of those charts that if you have any doubts about the validity of astrology, even if you don't know astrology, cast the chart, learn enough astrology to be able to read the chart, and you will see that it is an accurate chart of the incident. One of the most salient points that comes out is that at the exact moment of the mishap of an experiment, of a systems check that led to the Chernobyl disaster, the planet Uranus was rising. A planet rises for a while every day, but it only occupies the degree of the ascendant for about 4 minutes a day, and that's where Uranus was. It was within those exact 4 minutes with the planet Uranus rising that this mishap happened. And Uranus, of course, is the namesake of the element uranium, and it is also a planet associated with surprises and explosions and inventions, and in this case, inventions gone bad. Another interesting thing about this chart is that Uranus in Sagittarius is rising exactly, and both it and the ascendant in mid to late Sag happen to be aligned with this thing called the nuclear axis. The nuclear axis is a term that relates back to the chart for the first self-sustained atomic pile. That was done as part of the Manhattan Project. I believe that experiment was conducted under a tennis court at the University of Chicago, one of the temporary labs of the atomic bomb program, basically. In the previous segment of the interview, Carl goes through the other labs that that became basically permanently enshrined parts of the federal government. And in that chart, there's a very strong, streak through Gemini and Sagittarius. And it works out that almost every time there is a really significant nuclear event, of course, there aren't really that many insignificant nuclear events, but when there's a big one, there are planets lined up with that angle across Gemini and Sagittarius. And the Chernobyl chart is no exception, because there's a few things in Sagittarius, most notably Chiron, and then in the ascendant is Uranus, and then also Saturn is rising as well, but it's not as close to the ascendant. Saturn looks like it has risen, let's see, about 45 minutes before. So Saturn is still pretty powerful, and it's aligned with the nuclear axis. So this is a classical nuclear incident chart, but it was not any old accident. There was a massive release of contamination that basically, to some degree, covered the entire globe, although most of the radiation went to the Ukraine and to Belarus, and then a lot of it poured across Western Europe. It was really a nightmare. And you would think that when something like this happens, there would be a lot of second thoughts about nuclear power. And it turned out that there was a delay. The Three Mile Island accident of about 10 years before created a delay, and then Chernobyl created a delay in the opening of new nuclear power plants. According to the Wikipedia entry, it also cost the Soviet Union, rather, so much money that it debilitated the country's economy and led to the collapse of the USSR. So the depth of hubris in the use of nuclear power is so amazing, because a country, in some respects, has to risk its existence to be able to boil water. And we're trying to boil water in a universe where the most abundant thing there is energy. Everything is energy. And the sun is radiating out in all directions, nothing but pure energy. The wind is blowing, the currents are moving, the tides are changing, and then we have to split the atom to boil water? So something weird is going on there. And we really need to ask ourselves who these people are and what their agenda is. All right, there was one other thing I was going to say about this, but I'm drawing a blank on what it was, and as usual, I'm not working from notes. So I think what would be good to do now is to resume the interview with Carl Grossman and hear what he has to say. I will link part one from this same blog post. Altogether, the interview is about 100 minutes, so today's segment is going to be a little over 50 minutes. I know this might not be your issue. It's something of a depressing and complicated issue, but I think that it is really one of the things that is the essence of the times in which we are alive. We live in the time of the split atom. And this is a change in the course of history that is unlike any other. Carl argues that it really is possible for us to get wise and to put the nuclear genie back in the bottle. I really, really hope that he is right. But if he is right, the way that is going to happen, as you'll hear with the closing down of the Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant on Long Island, is that it's going to take a lot of attention focused on it. There's going to be necessary for many people to have unbelievably large amounts of awareness and the willingness to take action. All right, so I will step off my soapbox and leave you in the capable hands of someone who actually knows what he's talking about, and that would be Carl Grossman, interviewed out in Sag Harbor, New York, part two. Thanks for listening.
Let me state unequivocally that I never met a nuclear plant I didn't like, said John Rowe, who retired 17 days ago as chairman and CEO of Exelon, which operates, it's the biggest nuclear utility in the U.S., 22 nuclear plants, and new ones don't make any sense right now. Let's see what publication this is from. It's from, of all places, Forbes.com. Not even a technological publication. It's from a business publication. Yeah. I mean, from a business sense, nuclear makes no sense. And in fact, there isn't any nuclear except where governments at this point provide a subsidy.
Well, no one will insure them. It's so, the risk is so huge.
Well, what we have is a limit of liability. I think most people are not familiar. I mean, in cover up, what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power, what I do in the beginning is talk about how when this nuclear establishment, particularly we're talking about the Atomic Energy Commission, what grew out of the Manhattan Project, started to push nuclear. The utilities, if you remember your Monopoly game, utilities are very conservative cards, didn't want to touch this. They didn't want to take the exposure of the liability. And a pivotal year was 1957. In 1957, the first commercial nuclear plant was built in the United States, Shippingport in Pennsylvania, but it was built by the government. Admiral Hyman Rickover was in charge of the construction of Shippingport.
Is he related to Admiral Rickover?
He was Admiral Hyman Rickover. He was in charge of construction of Shippingport. Shippingport opens in 1957. And in 1957, and that's talking about carrots and sticks. That's the stick. Louis Strauss, who was chairman of the AEC, says, as Shippingport opens, to the utilities, if you don't build these plants, we, the government, will. We, the government, will. And in fact, in that period in the 50s, in terms of planning for nuclear power plants, you see on the planning documents, government control site, government control site. Also in 57, the Price-Anderson Act was passed. And Price-Anderson was a way for the utilities, this is the carrot, to have nuclear power plants without having the exposure. It limited the liability in the event of a nuclear power plant accident to $560 million, with the government paying the first $500 million. And that's the limit. I mean, that was the limit. It was supposed to be a temporary act just to get the fledgling nuclear industry off the ground. Supposed to be just run for 10 years, the Price-Anderson Act. But it's been renewed, and just a few years ago it was renewed again. Now the limit isn't $560 million. It's, I think the liability limit now is, I think it's $11.5 billion. Yeah, but 11.5 billion. Look at Fukushima. Look at Chernobyl. I mean, the damage is there. Unbelievable. And we're talking hundreds of billions, if not for Fukushima, into the trillions. But in any case, there's this back to cover up, just to punctuate the point. I note that in the United States, on everybody's insurance policy, there's this nuclear clause or radiation clause. I mean, just if you're listening to this, you own a home, go look at your homeowner's insurance policy. And here I reprint my own, Allstate Insurance. I mean, it's reprinted as a facsimile in the book, which incidentally is available. If anybody wants this book, it's available for free online from the publisher. Just go to thepermanentpress.com. thepermanentpress.com.
I'll link to it.
And just go to cover up what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power. And the publisher, this is after Fukushima, made the book available with this documentation, which is it's an old book, but the documentation is unfortunately as critical now as it was critical then. In any case, in everybody's insurance, homeowners and policy in the United States, there's this, and here I'm just reading from it, nuclear clause. This policy does not cover loss or damage caused by nuclear reaction or nuclear radiation or radioactive contamination. I mean, if it's so safe, why can't, why can't it be? If you trip on my front step today when you leave, Eric, you know, you could sue. Don't, please, but you could sue. That's like basic Anglo-Saxon tort law that you can sue if you're damaged, but not when it comes to nuclear technology. So you have, and then incidentally, in this period, in the 50s, somebody might say that, the nuclear folks didn't know the consequences. The first major report on the consequences of a nuclear plant accident came out in 1957, too. And it was done at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And I reprint the report, parts of the report, in the book. It's called WASH 740 for Washington. It was done at Brookhaven National Laboratory, as I say. And it talked about, they were evaluating a nuclear plant, the 10th the size of the kind of plants that were eventually built. Here, it's titled, here's the book, here's the report, it's right in the book. Theoretical Possibilities and Consequences of Major Accidents in Large Nuclear Power Plants.
Do not circulate, it's written on top.
Do not circulate. Do not circulate. Brookhaven National Laboratory. And here, for the three types of assumed accidents, the theoretical estimates indicate that personal damage right range to an upper limit of 3,400 killed, 43,000 injured. Worst case in terms of property damage, $7 billion. So the same year Price Anderson is enacted.
In 57?
57.
$7 billion?
Yeah. The same year Price Anderson is enacted in 57.
Limiting to
$560 million, with the government paying the first $500 million. Here's this report, $7 billion. And again, they're talking about plants 100 to 200 megawatts. And so what they did at Brookhaven Lab later, incidentally, was to do a second report called WASH 740 Update, because ultimately plants were built at 1,000 megawatts, 820. The GE plants, boiling water, like these Mark 1s, Westinghouse's with 1,050, the pressurized water. And here in WASH 740 Update, and I reprint this line, which is repeated over and over again, in WASH 740 Update, the possible size of the area of such a disaster, they're talking about a nuclear plant accident, might be equal to that of the state of Pennsylvania.
And they're right.
Well, they're not only right, but this is 10 years, this is in the 60s, 10 years before Three Mile Island almost caused the disaster that took out the state of Pennsylvania. So again, all these three things happened in 57. The carrot, the Price Anderson Act, the stick, we're going to build them if you don't build them, and the knowledge that these machines can cause all kind of deaths. And just before we leave Rickover, not that many years later, in 1982, Rickover resigns from the Navy, retires from the Navy.
As an admiral.
Yeah, and he speaks to a committee of Congress, the Joint Economic Committee, gives a speech, which is available on the internet. And in the paperback edition of Cover Up, my first book was 80, but this is 82, and the paperback came out in 82. As an afterword, I use a couple of pages from the speech. Now, this is really important. Here he gets right to the essence of it. Again, this is the father of the nuclear navy, the man in charge of the construction of the first nuclear plant in the U.S. And he says, I'll be philosophical. Until a few billion years ago, it was impossible to have any life on Earth. That is, there was so much radiation on Earth, you couldn't have any life, fish or anything. What he's talking about is these lighter elements, these fission products that are produced. I mean, then it wasn't nuclear power plants, obviously, but in the creation of the planet, they were produced out of cosmic radiation, these poisonous substances, the strontium-90 and the iodine-131 and the you get all these horrible cesium-137. Gradually, about a few billion years ago, the amount of radiation on this planet and probably in the entire system reduced and made it possible for some form of life to begin. And that amount of radiation had been gradually decreasing because all radiation has a half-life, which means ultimately there'll be no radiation. Now, says Rickover, when we go back to using nuclear power, we are creating something which nature tried to destroy to make life possible. Every time, and this is Rickover, not Greenpeace, every time you produce radiation, a horrible force is unleashed. And in some cases, some of the so-called nuclear waste, and it's not nuclear, people think of nuclear waste, like ashes that you have after a fire is out. No, no. It's what you turn uranium and plutonium into, potentially. If you have breeder reactors, you'd use plutonium.
When you produce nuclear waste.
He says, in some cases, this horrible force, he's talking about these nuclear poisons, is unleashed, and in some cases, they'll be around for billions of years. This is, again, the nuclear so-called waste. And again, this is Rickover, and I think there the human race is going to wreck itself. And he says nuclear power is not worth it because it creates radiation. And what he urges, again, this is Rickover, that we outlaw. I think from a long-range standpoint, I'm talking about the humanity. The most important thing we could do is start in having an international meeting where we first outlaw nuclear weapons to start with, then we outlaw nuclear reactors too. And let me repeat that. This is, again, Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear Navy, the person deeply involved in the U.S. nuclear power program and nuclear weapons program. I think from a long-range standpoint, I'm talking about humanity, the most important thing we could do is start in having an international meeting where we first outlaw nuclear weapons to start with, then we outlaw nuclear reactors too. And, you know, and that's the story. The problem is, going back to, you know, how we started, it's mind-boggling. I mean, this is kind of beyond denial. I mean, here, for example, is a new report from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Atomic Energy Commission, incidentally, was abolished in 1974 because it was set up both to promote and to regulate nuclear power. And even Congress, which has long been in the pockets of the nuclear industry,
realized the conflict of interest.
So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was set up ostensibly as an independent regulator, and ultimately there was a Department of Energy created to promote atomic energy. In fact, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the culture remains the same as it was at the when it was the Atomic Energy Commission. And this is a report from just last month, February 2012, where in terms of those various other analysis that I spoke about, WASH-7 of catastrophic reactor consequences, nuclear plant consequences. You had originally WASH 740, then WASH 740 update. And then you had something called CRAC 2, Calculation Reactor Accident Consequences 2. It was done at Sandia National Laboratories by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1982. And it projects, in a major nuclear power plant accident, they're talking a meltdown with breach of containment. For example, the Indian Point nuclear plants just above New York City, essentially near, I think they talk 70,000, 80,000 prompt fatalities, tens of thousands of cancer deaths, injuries, property damage in $1980 for each of these Indian Point plants, $300 billion. In other words, in our dollar today, $1 trillion in property damage. Again, that was the most recent report, CRAC 2, which you can Google and you can see. And then they have an analysis, a projection in CRAC 2 for every nuclear plant in the United States. And in fact, the Chernobyl and now Fukushima accidents show that what Crack 2 estimated was actually a minimum. I mean, Sandia National Laboratories is also a Department of Energy laboratory. It's, again, all out of this nuclear establishment. So Crack 2 was lowballing it. But what now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has done, this is in the wake of Fukushima, is put out a whole new analysis of nuclear power plant accident impacts. It's called State-of-the-Art Reactor Consequence Analysis, SOARCA. That's the acronym. And what they conclude, this is the findings, this is a nuclear regulatory document that I'm reading from. The main findings were existing resources and procedures can stop an accident. I mean, tell that to the people around Fukushima and Chernobyl. Slow it down or reduce its impact before it can affect public health. Even if accidents proceed uncontrolled, they take much longer to happen and release much less radioactive material than earlier analysis suggested. And again, the early analysis, if anything, minimized what's going to happen, as proven by Chernobyl and Fukushima. And here, this is the bottom line. This is the newest U.S. government projection after Fukushima and Chernobyl. The analyzed accidents would cause essentially zero immediate deaths and only a very, very small increase in the risk of long-term cancer deaths. In fact, they say maybe 1 in a billion population would have cancer, considering we have, 6 or 7 billion people on the Earth?
Oh, six people.
Six yeah. people. So that's not... I mean, if to say these people are nuclear Pinocchios, to say they're liars for hire, to say they are in violation of the Nuremberg principles for crimes against humanity, I mean, this only begins to, it only begins to describe what these characters are up to. I mean, this is mass murder. This is mass murder, what they're up to. And it is, in a way, kind of a perfect crime, because it takes a while for the people to die.
Yeah, you shoot the bullet and it just goes floating by and you left the scene a long time ago.
Yeah. And now to cover it all up in the wake of Fukushima and Chernobyl, with all this kind of baloney, this malarkey, this deception, this deceit. I mean, Goebbels, Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Nazis, has to be smiling in his grave at what must stand to be the biggest. I mean, there's plenty of big lies in history, But what we're in the midst of now, in terms of nuclear technology, has to be the biggest, the big. Among the, if not the biggest, big lies of all times.
Well, if we go back, I'm always thinking about the psychology of these things and the people involved, and I've been trying to psychoanalyze my dad and his position on this for a long time and challenging his viewpoints. And then, you know, I've read a lot of the files out of Westinghouse and GE on the creation of PCBs and dioxin. They were busy producing all this crap at the same time. But the nuclear thing, the DNA separated at birth between the peaceful atom, the peaceful thing that kills everyone, and the friendly and the mean one, is that they have the same DNA. They're born from the same idea and from the same concept. And that concept was, if you believe Jonathan Schell, 13 detonations or something over cities can bring on nuclear winter. Their goal was to destroy the planet, mutually assured destruction and doomsday machine type of things. That's the idea. Why wouldn't it carry into a kind of a, you know, paint it with a new color in this, you know, friendly face of nuclear peaceful atoms? But it's the same stuff.
It's the same stuff. And for these folks, you know, some say, I don't, but some say that guilt-stricken physicists and guilt-stricken nuclear engineers after the war sought to promote civilian nuclear power to assuage their conscience.
For piling up the planet up with nuclear bombs.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. And going through the literature, I mentioned that book, City of Fire, which is an excellent documentation of the desperation at Los Alamos after the war. What else are we going to do? What else are we going to do with nuclear and how they seek out other things to do? David Lilienthal, who was also chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission for several years and then parted ways with the nuclear establishment, also has written about this in his work. He has a book, I think it's called Truth, something or other in the bomb, but it's by David Lilienthal. Also this desperation, how these laboratories turned into be these lavish facilities with these scientists looking for money from any source to do things nuclear to advance their... I see it as vested interest. I see it as an attempt to perpetuate what they've been up to. But nevertheless, for whatever reason you want to ascribe, whether it's guilt or whether it's greed, I think mainly it's greed, there has been this this denial, this huge, huge denial. Oh, and just one of the, this is a footnote, but it's an important footnote because you just mentioned Westinghouse and GE. And I earlier talked about them being the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power worldwide. Well, a funny thing happened in the year 2009. A company called Toshiba bought Westinghouse. Toshiba.
Somebody finally bought Westinghouse?
Well, it's... this Coke and Pepsi, this nuclear Coke and Pepsi were bought by one component. The Westinghouse was bought by Toshiba. I mean, if you look at the internet, it's now Toshiba Westinghouse. And the nuclear division of GE was bought by Hitachi. Hitachi. So...
we're going to have nuclear vibrators, the Hitachi magic wand.
Well, see, the it isn't just, I mean, people have been screaming ever since Fukushima about TEPCO, this Tokyo Electric Power Company, which has been lying through its teeth and attempting to manipulate the Japanese government. Well, the Japanese government, which is very much manipulated by corporate power, has more at stake than just TEPCO, or is more involved than just TEPCO. You have now the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power are Japanese brands, basically. I mean, GE is in partnership with Hitachi, but on the Westinghouse side of things, it is 100% Toshiba now. And they want to sell more nuclear power plants. So like when the, I think his name was Kan, the prime minister of Japan, with Fukushima, I mean, he just recently was, this was on Frontline on PBS, revealed that part of the plan initially as the accident was beginning was that we may have to evacuate Tokyo. I mean, he understood the scale of it all and the folly of it all, I think he began to absorb. And he began to then say no nuclear power in Japan. And who was pushed out of office in Japan? It's said by pro-nuclear interests. But this fellow, meanwhile, though, in Japan, I mean, the Japanese public, and it's in a very obedient public usually, they've risen. And I mean, there's only a couple of nuclear plants in Japan. I think they have 53 or 55 in operation now. And Japan is doing fine. I mean, they're not sitting around, you know, reading under a candle. I mean, like it was so needed after the 55 plants go out, you know, well, not all 55, you know, or 53. You have just a couple working, and Japan is still functioning. It's been interesting after Fukushima that where there's been democracy, basically, even a semblance of democracy, people have been able to, like the Japanese, rise and move against nuclear power. I mean, a sterling example is Germany. There were elections right after Fukushima, a month or two afterwards, And the Greens won major victories. And even though Merkel, the chancellor, she's a physicist, supported nuclear power, she took 180. Because of the Democratic, the Democratic declaration of the people of Germany, the German government has declared, we're shutting down all our nuclear plants. I think they have 12 or 14. And we're going to renewables. We're going safe, clean, renewable energy technology. And that was followed up by, again, people sometimes would like to blame industry for all of this. And industry sure deserves blame. Westinghouse and GE and Stone and Webster and Exelon and Entergy. God knows, Entergy and Exelon. Just awful, awful nuclear utilities. Entergy is the company that owns Indian Point. In any case, they shoulder so much of the blame. So much of this is these government nuclear establishments. Because once the German government said, we're out of this, we're out of nuclear, we're going safe, clean, renewable, Siemens, which is the manufacturer of all the German nuclear plants, announced they were out of the nuclear business. And then other countries let me know, Italy, there was a referendum on nuclear power. Berlusconi loved nuclear power. He was still the, you know, in charge of Italy. And there was a referendum after Fukushima on whether Italy wanted to build new nuclear power plants. 93% of the people voting said no. And that was the end of nuclear power in Italy. In Switzerland, there was a vote in their parliament post-Fukushima. And it's these countries which, and I'm very ashamed to say, my country, the United States, where democracy has not been able to be declared, to be stated, to be translated on nuclear power. I mean, here, just a couple of weeks ago now, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, again, which has been willy-nilly allowing these nuclear plants to operate for 60 years, it just gave permission for two new nuclear power plants to be built down south. This is the Vogtle nuclear power plants in Georgia. And it's apparently going to soon give permission for two new nuclear power plants to be built. These are all Westinghouse plants in South Carolina. So here in this country, although polls have shown people after Fukushima are against nuclear and for safe, clean, renewable nuclear power, here democracy has been suppressed. I must say that the record of President Obama on this is terrible. He's going around not talking about clean nuclear anymore. He just talks about clean energy, but he regards clean nuclear, what he's been calling clean nuclear, as part of clean energy. And he's been pushing, he's been barnstorming around him, pushing for more new nuclear power. This is after Fukushima, more new nuclear power plants. I've written about this and his connections to, I mentioned Exelon before. Well, that guy Rowe, the former chairman, very, very tight with Obama, big contributor. In fact, Forbes had a piece earlier about nuclear and Obama and Rowe, and they talk about the White House's favorite utility, this Exelon, and how Rowe had carte blanche in the White House. And Rahm Emanuel, who was the chief of staff for initially for the first several years for Obama's first administration, now mayor of Chicago. Well, it turns out between being a congressman and being chief of staff for the Obama White House, Rahm Emanuel, as an investment banker, put together Exelon. It had been Commonwealth Edison, and he added a Philadelphia utility, and he put together what became the biggest nuclear utility in the country, in David Axelrod. He's still the chief political strategist for Obama. Guess it was PR. Guess it was the public relations consultant to Exelon. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just kind of follow the dots here. And Obama, when he was running for president, I mean, again, I've written about this, and I've written about how he tells the Keene, New Hampshire editorial board that he's against nuclear power. Problem is that these machines, he said right out. I mean, it isn't like George Bush being just dopey and not knowing. But Obama says the problem with these machines is that they can blow up and kill people. Paraphrasing, but very close to what he said. And much better off with safe, clean, renewable energy technology like solar and so forth. Became president between John Roe, Rahm Emanuel, and David Axelrod. Suddenly Obama went nuclear, pushing these nuclear loan guarantees. I mean, these Vogtle plants, they're predicated, these Westinghouse plants that are to be built, they're predicated on progress, energy, getting a loan guarantee, billions of dollars, our taxpayer dollars, because Wall Street doesn't want to touch nuclear power, that Obama has been pushing as well, loan guarantees to build new nuclear power plants.
So, you know, we've seen a tipping point in Germany, Switzerland, you mentioned. In the United States, what do you think the turning point will be, and who is going to take up the task of educating people here?
Oh, man, that's such a question. That's such a question, because you don't see any difference, really, between the Democrats and the Republicans. There's a handful of Congress people who aren't in the pocket of the nuclear industry. Edward Markey from Massachusetts is one of them.
How's the District 1 guy here?
No, he's a guy named Tim Bishop. He has become pro-nuclear. And in Long Island, there was this big fight against nuclear power, and all you would think. No, this is going to take, and everybody's going to have to be involved. Like here on Long Island, the plan was to build many nuclear power plants. I mean, this sounds crazy, and I wrote a book about this. It's called Power Crazy. Con Edison wanted to build a nuclear power plant. This is in 1960 in Ravenswood in Queens in New York, just to the north of the Queens Midtown Tunnel. It's just north of the, it's right along the Queens border with, I mean, there's the East River, and the United Nations is across the river. And Con Ed wanted to build a nuclear plant. Ravenswood won back in 1960. And my book, Power Crazy, is about this, because what occurs is that folks in New York who knew about nuclear power protested. And Con Ed, and there was a bill in the city council to preclude the siting of a nuclear plant within the boundaries of New York City. And Con Ed just forget it. They just turned tail and ran and canceled the project. Oh, meanwhile, there was people at the Atomic Energy Commission saying, we can engineer safeguards. You could maybe have a nuclear plant in the middle of a city. In fact, in Russia, many of their nuclear plants are in the middle of cities. Sure. I remember the first nuclear plant I saw in Russia was the first visit I was there. I was there to help in the development of a new environmental program for Russia. I was invited by environmentalists from Russia. And Voronezh is this big nuclear plant in the middle of this big city of 1 million people with these huge pipes. I mean, not only does it provide electricity, but there's these huge pipes, like 6-8 feet, that provide to these, like Soviet era, Stalin era apartment complexes, radiation tinged steam heat. So they, now the former Soviet Union, Russia, they use their nukes to produce plutonium for weapons, for steam heat when they're near a popular, well, here in the middle of a city. Voronezh has them right in the middle of the, in any case, what occurred after the end of Ravenswood is that Brookhaven National Laboratory on Long Island, which was established in 1947, particularly to develop civilian uses of nuclear technology, to do atomic research, but to really, that's why WASH 740 and WASH 740 update was done at Brookhaven Lab. In fact, only in recent years, they've reactivated their nuclear division. For a while, they closed down on nuclear because they had been making such a big mess leaking tritium into the Long Island groundwater. Their two reactors were shut down. In fact, there's a new film out called Atomic States of America, based on a book about Shirley, Long Island. The author of the book connects widespread cancer in Shirley to Brookhaven Lab. In any case, the scientists from Brookhaven Lab, the engineers from Brookhaven Lab, joined with the local Long Island utility, the Long Island Lighting Company, in a scheme to build, that's why the book is called Power Crazy, 7 to 11 nuclear plants on Long Island, with the first being the Shoreham nuclear plant.
You're talking real plants, not like little puppy plants. No. Shoreham was a big, multi-billion, like a $3 billion project.
It was an 820 megawatt General Electric Mark I reactor.
Cool.
Power, just like Fukushima.
And same it was model. Built and tested.
Yeah, it was built and tested.
The bastards tested it, and they thought, oh, we'll test it, and they won't be able to turn it down. But how does Shoreham get killed?
How it got killed.
I consider that a miracle.
I've gotten to this issue because you ask, how can nuclear power be stopped in America?
Yeah, the tipping point in the United States.
What happened is that people became aware on Long Island about the dangers of nuclear power. There was some good journalism, and I must say I did some of it. It was not done by the mainstream media. The New York Times and Newsday kept pushing Shoreham to the very end. These are the two big daily papers in the area, but I did a lot of writing. Suffolk Life doesn't exist anymore, but it was a weekly paper. It was excellent. And this is before really the internet. People got to understand one-to-one. Three Mile Island happened in 79. Chernobyl in 86. I mean, that was a major tipping point, Chernobyl. And meanwhile, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensed Shoreham to go into operation. In fact, prior to that, the Atomic Energy Commission licensed Shoreham to be built. And Shoreham was to be one of three nuclear plants on that site. There was supposed to be Shoreham 1, 2, and 3. Then to the east, about 30, 40 miles, also on the Long Island Sound, there was supposed to be four nuclear plants at Jamesport. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave permission for the first two to be built. There would be Westinghouse pressurized water reactor. I mean, if you figure out all the megawattage between Shoreham, the four at Jamesport, and the several in between along the Long Island Sound, it's far more than the 4,000 or 5,000 megawatts that Long Island, you know, used and still uses in terms of electricity. The deal was Long Island was to become, well, in the parlance of the 50s, in terms of Atomic Energy Commission language, a nuclear park. And and it was to provide nuclear-generated electricity to the entire Northeast, including New York City.
What a great idea. Just put it right where the entire population center is.
And the relationship with Brookhaven Lab was intimate to the end. In fact, the last chief executive officer and chairman of the Long Island Lighting Company was William Catacasinos, who was a former assistant director at Brookhaven Lab, pushing nuclear power. But in terms of how it was stopped essentially by any means possible. Politically, people worked to defeat pro-nuclear politicians. It was defeated by massive demonstrations, civil disobedience. In one, 600 people were arrested. Thousands of people took part. It was defeated by an end run made around the nuclear federal nuclear shutdown. See, the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, never denied a construction or operating license for any nuclear plant anywhere, anytime in the U.S. So what was thought of by some very far-sighted fellows who I know well, Murray Barbash, his brother-in-law Irv Like is an environmental lawyer, was what we could do would be to use the state's power of eminent domain. See, like what happened with the nuclear endeavor was, this goes way back to the 40s, is they cut out local involvement. They passed something called the Atomic Energy Act of 1947, which preempts states and localities. Still does. On issues of radiation and other dangers. However, there's this notion of eminent domain, which remains to this day, that like if the state wants to build a road, it can condemn like some property along the side of where a proposed road or where the road is to be widened, where a proposed road is to go, has the power of eminent domain. So what they did was Murray and Irv and a man by the name of Richie Kessel, who was the State Consumer Protection Board Chair, and others, is they worked on creating a Long Island Power Authority with the power of eminent domain to eliminate this Long Island Lighting Company, this private pro-nuke utility that was working closely with Brookhaven Lab, as a corporate entity if it persisted with nuclear power. And Long Island Power Act was passed. Long Island Power Authority was created. Kessel became its chairman. Irv Lyke became a member of the board. And it had the power to do in LILCO if it kept with Shoreham's, insisted on going into, having Shoreham go into commercial operation. And ultimately, LILCO, realizing the threat, gave up. Just turned Shoreham over for a dollar to LIPA, Long Island Power Authority, for decommissioning as a nuclear facility. And it was decommissioned. And LIPA has been there ever since. LILCO went out of business short time later. And
LIPA doesn't exist anymore.
No. And LIPA now is the utility on Long Island. And it's committed to, under the Long Island Power Act, to not only... you know, not only to close down Shoreham and these other nuclear projects on Long Island were not to be, but to promote safe, clean, renewable energy technology. So the lesson of Long Island in terms of the nation, and it was a big lesson because Shoreham was completed and went through low power testing with all kind of accidents. I mean, it's called a minor malfunctions happening, all kind of issues, incidents occurring. In Power Craze, I interview a guy named Ron Stanchfield, who had worked on the construction of, I believe it was 6 nuclear plants, and then Shoreham, and he said, and he was a whistleblower in Shoreham, if that plant is ever allowed to go into operation, his exact words are in Power Crazy, it's going to blow up. Not that any nuclear plant is safe, none of them are safe, but Shoreham was just horrendous, and it was stopped along with these other nuclear plants that were all part of this scheme. It was stopped by a combination of political action, civil disobedience, direct action, the clever use of law. There was also a RICO suit. RICO is racketeers. It's a suit, an anti-racketeering suit.
To stop the mob.
Yeah, well, not only the mob.
But it was expanded. Its purpose has grown.
What they charged here, well, actually, there was some mafia influence in terms of some of the unions at Shoreham, but that's another issue. Now, the RICO statute was utilized against LILCO, to wit, they were involved in a criminal enterprise, the construction of Shoreham, and were communicating about it on phones and stuff. So a RICO suit was brought by Suffolk County, New York. I mean, my point here
brought
in terms of
federal cause of action against LILCO.
Right. RICO suit was brought in federal court by Suffolk County. And all kind of disclosures came out of that. A jury found LILCO, in fact, guilty of a violation of the RICO statute. The judge, though, Weinstein, overturned what the jury did. And it was a complicated and problematic case, but it was all part of the actions that led to Long Island being nuclear free. And what I think is critical is that for the United States and for the world is that these precedents and more be followed. Creative use of law, direct action, political action, and so forth and so on, to stop. I mean, there's an old slogan, active today or radioactive tomorrow. And at no time is that more pertinent than today, that we must be active today rather than radioactive tomorrow.
Yeah.
We've done it.
Yeah.
Thank you, honey. I'm sorry, hon. Okay?
We've covered
we've
some territory.
It, honey, okay? Yep. Okay?
You're listening to Planet Waves FM. We've been speaking with Professor Carl Grossman at his home in Sag Harbor, New York, and we've been talking about all things nuclear. And we've concluded with the story of how the Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant, which was built and tested and supposed to be the capital, the first nuke in the Long Island Nuclear Park. Oh, my God, what a concept. these people are Dr. Strangelove. You know, Dr. Strangelove is the film that everyone wishes they had seen. And it's going to be like, first of all, it's almost as good as Sex. I mean, I realize it's a film about nuclear war, but the sly genius of this film, you will watch it four times. You're going to rent it once and you're going to wear it out. Dr. Strangelove, directed by Stanley Kubrick. And one other thing, Carl?
Yeah, let me just say one other thing, that the Dr. Strangelove, played beautifully by Peter Sellers, not beautifully, but incredibly by Peter Sellers in the film, beautifully. Was based on Edward Teller, one of the people who came out to Long Island to visit Einstein, to write this letter to Roosevelt to get it all going. And just a couple of issues here. At one point, Robert Oppenheimer, who was the scientific head of the Manhattan Project, has this conflict with, or has this how can I put it, this dialogue with Teller, and he says, this is Teller wants to go on with the super and build the hydrogen bomb, and he's Dr. Strangelove. I mean, he was the original Dr. Strangelove. And Oppenheimer, who had a real conscience, says, this is after the Manhattan Project and what it wrought. We physicists have sinned. And the other thing...
Oppenheimer says.
And the other thing that's very important is that Einstein, in his book, Out of My Later Years, which is available, he writes about what was wrought, and he says, I never would have lifted pen to paper if I knew the Germans wouldn't have gotten the bomb. I never would have lifted pen to paper. So, you know, what was wrought because of historical circumstances, then followed by greed and...
Entrenchment
and vested power, interest.
Power hungry. I mean, look at, we're surrounded by electrical gadgets.
Yeah, well, it's just, but they could, but there's solar on the roof of the house.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about...
It's a lot of energy in the universe. I mean,
yeah, and you could, and sometimes it's like yin and yang. It's like there's dark sides and there's the light. Indeed, I Cover up begins. I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live. And that's Deuteronomy. That's Deuteronomy. And humanity often has a choice between the dark side and life. Mm-hmm. And here I think we just must choose life, and we must undo, and we can undo, this terrible thing has been done, and move on for life ahead.
Yep. Carl, thank you for taking the time to speak to Planet Waves listeners once again. Alrighty. A difficult topic, I admit. I have spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I'm not sure why I am more at peace with it. It may be that I recognize that there's only so much I can do, but in that being aware and in spreading the word a little bit, as I can do, that represents some potential for things to go a little bit better in the future.
As I requested in part one, if you'd be kind enough, having listened this far, to post this the URL to this podcast to any of your favorite anti-nuclear sites, message boards, discussion groups, email lists, Facebook pages, or wherever else it might find a home. Grossman has many fans out there in the world and an unusual degree of notoriety and respect, given that he is on the anti-nuclear side. Right, seems like the pro-nuclear people get all the love, and that's just not very loving. We need to take better care of each other and better care of our planet. I'm planning to be back next week with a regular edition of Planet Waves FM. Who knows if I'll jump in before then. I know I have not covered any of the current astrology, but that was part of my plan this week. I'm in my cool-off-a-little-bit week, the cool-hour jets week at Planet Waves. We tend to run flat out a lot of the time, and I've been once a month just slowing down the movie and taking a bit of a break and giving my creative team a break. So we're working on a lot of office projects and things like that, and so we'll be back soon with a full edition of Planet Waves FM. I'm going to end today with one of my very favorite songs performed by the Grateful Dead, written by a Canadian folk artist named Bonnie Dobson. You may know the song. The song's called Morning Dew. I have long known that this was a song about the aftermath of nuclear war. Grateful Dead were not really very activist, but they had a couple of moments where when the point reached the level of an existential idea, they would speak up. And so the Grateful Dead adapted and to some extent reworked slightly the lyrics of Bonnie Dobson, and this is one of the songs that they have made their own. Now, I thought I would check out the Wikipedia page for this song. I maybe came across this information once before, and if I did, I forgot it, but it seems familiar, that the song was inspired when Bonnie Dobson saw the film On the Beach. On the Beach is a story of the world post-nuclear war. I guess in the late 50s and early 1960s, people were thinking about this topic a lot more than we do today. Of course, today we have the excuse of thinking we have so many more problems, but the truth is that this is one of our biggest problems and one of the ones that we really should get going on. I have never seen On the Beach, amazingly, but I just read the description, and it is, even the description by Wikipedia editors is positively haunting, involving a nuclear war breaking out in North America, which has contaminated North America, and the only places that at the point of the film's action are currently safe are places way in the southern part of the southern hemisphere, including Australia and Antarctica. Everyone else is dead, and they pick up the Australians pick up a telegraph signal, a Morse code signal coming out of, they figure out that it's coming from San Francisco, and they send a submarine up the west coast of the United States to investigate, and that is what the story is. In any event, Morning Dew, as you will hear, has a life of its own. This recording was made in April of 1971 in New York City at a place called the Fillmore East. Once again, thanks for listening to Planet Waves FM. This has been the regular edition combined with a special edition for Wednesday, April the 25th, 2012. I will catch you on a different day.
But I heard a young man today. I can walk you out in the morning, do my honey. I guess it doesn't matter anyway. I guess it doesn't matter anyway. Yes, it doesn't matter anyway. Thank you.